Our first reading is in Psalm 54, please. Psalm 54. We are, as some of you know, studying 1 Samuel 23. But reading number 1 comes from Psalm 54. It's a psalm of David. When the Ziphites came, said to Saul, "Doth not David hide himself with us? Save me, O God, by thy name, and judge me by thy strength. Hear my prayer, O God. Give ear to the words of my mouth, for strangers are risen up against me, and oppressors seek after my soul. They have not set God before them." Selah. "Behold, God is mine helper. The Lord is with, or the Lord is among them that uphold my soul. He shall reward evil unto mine enemies. Cut them off in thy truth. I will freely sacrifice unto thee. I will praise thy name, O Lord, for it is good. For he hath delivered me out of all my trouble, and mine eye hath seen his desire upon mine enemies." 1 Samuel chapter 23, please. 1 Samuel chapter 23. Then they told David, saying, "Behold, the Philistines fight against Keilah, and they rob the threshing floors." Therefore David inquired of the Lord, saying, "Shall I go and smite these Philistines?" The Lord said unto David, "Go and smite the Philistines, and save Keilah." And David's men said unto him, "Behold, we be afraid here in Judah. How much more then if we come to Keilah against the armies of the Philistines?" Then David inquired of the Lord yet again. And the Lord answered him and said, "Arise, go down to Keilah, for I will deliver the Philistines into thine hand." So David and his men went to Keilah, and fought with the Philistines, and brought away their cattle, and smote them with a great slaughter. So David saved the inhabitants of Keilah. It came to pass, when Abiathar, the son of Ahimelech, fled to David to Keilah, that he came down with an ephod in his hand. And it was told Saul that David was come to Keilah. And Saul said, "God hath delivered him into mine hand, for he is shut in by entering into a town that hath gates and bars." And Saul called all the people together to war, to go down to Keilah, to besiege David and his men. And David knew that Saul secretly practiced mischief against him. He said to Abiathar the priest, "Bring hither the ephod." Then said David, "O Lord God of Israel, thy servant hath certainly heard that Saul seeketh to come to Keilah, to destroy the city for my sake. Will the men of Keilah deliver me up into his hand? Will Saul come down as thy servant hath heard? O Lord God of Israel, I beseech thee, tell thy servant." And the Lord said, "He will come down. Then said David, will the men of Keilah deliver me and my men into the hand of Saul? And the Lord said, they will deliver thee up. Then David and his men, which were about 600, arose and departed out of Keilah, and went whithersoever they could go. And it was told Saul that David was escaped from Keilah, and he forbare to go forth. And David abode in the wilderness in strongholds, and remained in a mountain in the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul sought him every day, but God delivered him not into his hand. And David saw that Saul was come out to seek his life. And David was in the wilderness of Ziph in a wood. And Jonathan, Saul's son, arose and went to David into the wood, and strengthened his hand in God. And he said unto him, fear not, for the hand of Saul my father shall not find thee, and thou shalt be king over Israel, and I shall be next unto thee. And that also Saul my father knoweth. And they two made a covenant before the Lord. And David abode in the wood, and Jonathan went to his house. Then came up the Ziphites to Saul to Gibeah, saying, doth not David hide himself with us in strongholds in the wood, in the hill of Achilah, which is on the south of Jeshimon? Now therefore, O king, come down according to all the desire of thy soul to come down, and our part shall be to deliver him into the king's hand. And Saul said, blessed be ye of the Lord, for ye have compassion on me. Go, I pray you, prepare yet, and know, and see his place where his haunt is, and who hath seen him there, for it is told me that he dealeth very subtly. See therefore, and take knowledge of all the lurking places where he hideth himself, and come ye again to me with a certainty, and I will go with you. And it shall come to pass, if he be in the land, that I will search him out throughout all the thousands of Judah. And they arose, and went to Ziph before Saul. But David and his men were in the wilderness of Maon, in the plain on the south of Jeshimon. Saul also and his men went to seek him. And they told David. Wherefore he came down into a rock, and abode in the wilderness of Maon. And when Saul heard that, he pursued after David in the wilderness of Maon. And Saul went on this side of the mountain, and David and his men on that side of the mountain. And David made haste to get away for fear of Saul. For Saul and his men compassed David and his men round about to take them. But there came a messenger unto Saul, saying, haste and come, the Philistines have invaded the land. Wherefore Saul returned from pursuing after David, and went against the Philistines. Therefore they called that place Selah Hamalakoth. And David went up from thence, and dwelt in strongholds at Engedi. It came to pass, when Saul was returned from following the Philistines, that it was told him, saying, behold, David is in the wilderness of Engedi. So we noticed in past weeks, early weeks. Our chapter opens with the man of Keilah being saved. That's the Spirit's language there. Saved, that is, immediately by David, of course, but in a deeper sense, more ultimately, finally, by the Lord himself, which was made clear in what I read to you. And the chapter closes with David being saved, immediately by the Philistines, of all people, but in a deeper sense, and ultimately, by the Lord himself. In more detail, as we said, the first section, verses 1 to 6, Keilah saved by David from the Philistines. The last section, 27 to 29, David saved from Saul by the Philistines. And then as you move in toward the middle, verses 7 to 13, the men of Keilah willing to, quote, deliver David into Saul's hand. Moving now from the back inwards, verses 19 to 26, the men of Ziph willing to, quote, deliver David into Saul's hand. In verses 7 to 13, David was in great danger of being enclosed in a town. Verses 19 to 26, he was in great danger of being enclosed in the wilderness. And then sandwiched right in the middle, verses 14 to 18, David's hand strengthened in God by noble, loyal, royal Jonathan. For this, our third and final week, we're going to focus on the closing two sections of the chapter. So we take up the story, therefore, in verses 19 and 20, when, quote, the Ziphites came up to Saul to Gibeah, saying, doth not David hide himself with us? And as the chapter is constructed, the treachery of the Ziphites stands in striking contrast to the loyalty, the renewed friendship of Jonathan, which it follows immediately behind in verses 16 to 18. We will deliver him into the king's hand. Watch the way the Spirit tells the story, and note the contrast between these verses and verse 16. Because whereas in verse 16, Jonathan, quote, went to David and strengthened his hand, in God that is, in verses 19 and 20, the men of Ziph came to Saul and volunteered to deliver David into the king's hand. David is now Israel's most wanted man. A man, you might almost say, with a price on his head, who can no longer be sure of anyone, who can no longer trust anybody, even men of his own tribe. Because according to the book of Joshua chapter 15, Ziph is numbered among one of the, quote, cities of the tribe of the children of Judah, which of course was David's own. Hence Saul's vicious comment in verse 23 about searching David out throughout all the thousands of Judah. Sought refuge among his own people. And a fat lot of good it did him. And sadly, these men of Ziph are as ready to hand David over to Saul as would, given the chance, the men of Keilah, verse 12, same language, but with far less excuse. Saul and the assembled army of Israel weren't coming down to destroy the city of the men of Ziph. At least the men of Keilah had some excuse. Verse 21. Saul said, blessed be ye of the Lord. Another mouthful of Saul's pious talk. Earlier, verse 7, he'd spoken gleefully of God having delivered David into his hand. And now here he is wishing the blessing of the Lord on those who are prepared to deliver him into his hand. And it's frightening to find such free and easy reference to God on the lips of a man who had absolutely no place for him in his heart. And Saul fits very well into that description given by the Lord through Isaiah in chapter 29 of his book about those who draw near to me with their mouth and with their lips to honour me, but have removed their heart far from me. Ah yes, Saul fitted into that category remarkably well. Ye have compassion on me. When you take that with Saul's earlier outburst at Gibeah when sitting under his tamarisk tree in chapter 22, verse 8, there is none of you that is sorry for me. Says a lot about his very deep feelings of self-pity. Poor, poor me. But you might recall that Saul hadn't been quite so strong on compassion himself back in verse 1, when it was others, namely the men of Keilah, who were in real trouble. Verse 22. Know and see his place where his haunt is, literally where his foot is. That is, you go and track him down as you would a wild beast and report back. Verses 24 and 5. David and his men were in the wilderness of Maon. Now, the wilderness of Maon's about 5 miles south of Ziph. It's in the much larger wilderness of Judah. It's only a few miles' journey away. And when Saul heard, he pursued after David. Now, you need to capture the atmosphere of the chapter. The Spirit of God is painting a particular picture for us. The tension mounts. And at this point in the chapter, David's situation is becoming desperate. The title of Psalm 54 reads, A Psalm of David. When the Ziphites came and said to Saul, Doth not David hide himself with us? Now I concede that David in chapter 26 would again have been betrayed by the men of Ziph. There is a rerun of the story at the beginning of chapter 26, but the exact title, of the exact wording of the title of Psalm 54 occurs only here in chapter 23, verse 19. And apart from that, the circumstances of my chapter seem to fit Psalm 54 rather better than those in chapter 26. So I'm happy to locate Psalm 54 in David's experience in my chapter. And it seems to me, I can't prove it, that it was Saul's approach in verse 25 which prompted the passionate opening cry of his psalm. When, without any preamble, David goes straight to the point, cries out, Save me, O God! By thy name, judge me, that is, vindicate me, by thy strength. And I tell you, well might David plead, for God to put forth his strength, because in human terms, David and his men, as they are labelled in verse 24, had precious little strength compared to that of Saul and his men in verse 25. Saul's standing army consisted of 3,000 elite troops, crack troops. David's got 600, and a motley crew they were, some of them. But David is not without hope. Because at the structural centre of the psalm, exactly midpoint, we find his firm confidence. God is my helper. The Lord is among them that uphold my soul. Yeah. David's oppressors may not have set God before them. Now that's a quote, that's Psalm 54, verse 3. They hadn't set God before them, but David most certainly had set God before him. And sometimes the Lord sees fit to permit his people to be reduced to dire straits that they might flee to the rock. Not to the rock of Maon, verse 25, but to the rock. The rock of Israel, and I'm fascinated to see that David himself will later sing, 5 times over in 2 Samuel 22 and 3 of the Lord as his rock. Oh, David had a better rock than the rock of Maon. But you've got to wait for a few minutes to find that out. And when David now asserted, God is my helper, he little realized just how much he was shortly going to need his help. And he would never have guessed through whom God would send him his help. Verse 26. Saul went on this side of the mountain, and David and his men on that side of the mountain. David made haste to get away for fear of Saul, for Saul and his men compassed David and his men round about to take them. Now this is a real nail-biter. At this point in the narrative, the tension becomes almost unbearable. David made haste to get away for fear of Saul. So says the English Bible, the King James Bible. Literally, David was fleeing in terror, in panic, to go from the face of Saul. Saul and his men compassed David and his men round about. Guided by the Ziphites, Saul and his men had been gradually drawing the net tighter and tighter around David and his. And now they have practically enclosed them. Now David is not only hopelessly outnumbered, but also more or less surrounded. Doesn't say it, but the narrative implies that Saul had, very wisely, divided his forces into two companies to attack both flanks of David and his men on the far side of the mountain, and they were now closing in on them. Although David and his men were frantically hurrying to get away, the Spirit says, Saul and his men were getting closer and closer, and finally, David was trapped. The Hebrew word translated here, compassed round about, is not the same that is usually translated compass or the like some 90 times in the King James Bible. No, not that word. This word is quite a rare word, only occurs 7 times in the whole Old Testament. It's the word which means to crown. Man is crowned with glory and honor, crowns the year with his goodness, and all that. And this word graphically describes the way in which David and his men were actually being encircled. All means of escape were being sealed off. There was no way out. And unlike Moses, David didn't even have a Red Sea to dry up for him. I wonder, did Saul at this point permit himself a wry smile? He'd earlier thought that he'd been able to trace the working of providence when he discovered David apparently cornered and enclosed in a fortified town. I read verses 7 and 8. Doesn't matter now that all that has come to nothing. Now he has David well and truly cornered and enclosed again, this time by the side of a mountain, and this time Saul is confident that his prey will not, indeed cannot, escape. And so it seemed. But then, Saul could be wrong. Perhaps God would intervene. Perhaps God would yet intervene in some dramatic, miraculous fashion to rescue his anointed king. Perhaps he would open up the earth to swallow his opponents, as he had done in Numbers chapter 16 for the benefit of Moses. Or perhaps he will rain fire from heaven on those who dare to send to apprehend his servant, as he will do in 2 Kings chapter 1 for the sake of Elijah. Or perhaps he will provide horses and chariots of fire to surround his servant to defend him, as he would one day for Elisha in 2 Kings chapter 6. Or maybe, send an angel from the throne to wipe out all the opposition one evening, as he would do one day in 2 Kings chapter 19 for Hezekiah and Isaiah when he annihilated the Assyrian army. Maybe. Is God then going to step into this dramatically and miraculously? Wait, what's all that shouting? Who's this breathless character frantically yelling for the king? Verse 27. But there came a messenger to Saul saying, "Haste and come. The Philistines have invaded the land." A messenger arrived to gasp out his urgent and disquieting news. Saul was to come post-haste. The Philistines had mounted a massive raid on the land. But who would ever have guessed? Who would ever have predicted such a dramatic development? Who would have predicted the arrival of the Israelite messenger at such a critical moment? I ask, but God's resources are limitless. He didn't need to send anything or anyone from heaven. Fire, horses and chariots of fire, angel. He didn't need to send anything or anyone from heaven to do his work. His enemies will do very nicely, thank you. Not that it's difficult, actually, to hazard a guess or two as to what it was inspired the Philistines to launch their attack at just that moment. In our chapter, there are lots of references to the intelligence networks, very effective intelligence networks, owned by Saul and David. They weren't the only people in the world with intelligent networks. The intelligence network of the Philistines had almost certainly picked up that Israel was especially vulnerable at this time, that the attention of Israel's monarch was now focused exclusively on some young rival for the throne. After all, had not Saul left their attack on Keilah's threshing floor pass unchallenged at the beginning of the chapter? And quite possibly the Philistine lords concluded that Saul's recent deployment of his standing army over at Ziph and Maon, way off to the east, gave them just the opportunity they'd been waiting for. The territory of Israel nearest their border stood completely unprotected. That might be why. It's a good enough reason. But on the other hand, it is by no means impossible that their attack came as a direct retaliation for the great slaughter, quote, which their raiding party had recently suffered courtesy of David at Keilah. That's verse 5. When I was talking about verse 3 2 weeks ago, I noted how the Philistines reacted back in chapter 13 of this book to Jonathan's enterprise. I quote the Bible, "Jonathan smote the garrison of the Philistines that was in Geba. And the Philistines heard of it, and the Philistines gathered themselves together to fight with Israel. 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, people as the sand which is on the seashore in multitude." The Philistines didn't like their comrades being wiped out. And it would indeed have been a delightful irony if it was David's good Samaritan deed at Keilah, which under God leads now to his rescue at Maon. But in the end, to be honest, we don't know. We don't know what human consideration stirred the Philistine war machine into action at this particular moment. Nor, thankfully, do we need to know. We know what we do need to know. We know that it was God's doing. We know that David's "Save me, O God" prayer had registered in heaven. David's God was not only at work behind the scenes. He was moving the seas. David once ended a psalm, it's Psalm 5, with the words, Lord, thou Lord, wilt bless the righteous with favor, with your good pleasure. Wilt thou compass him as with a shield? Now, I told you the word compass here in my chapter. It only occurs 7 times, and it's usually translated to crown 5 times. This is one. Psalm 5 is another. And with God's good pleasure to compass him as a shield to defend him, David has nothing to fear. When Saul and his men compassed him as a net to catch him. So if David had received a visit from an unexpected friend in the middle of the chapter 16 to 18, he now experienced a deliverance from an unexpected quarter. Unexpected quarter? That's some understatement for you. At the beginning of the chapter, David had rescued Keilah from the Philistines. Now at that time, the people he had saved would have surrendered him into Saul's hand. Now, the people he had smitten arrive on the scene to save him out of Saul's hand. Oh, the Lord does enjoy doing this. I want you to note how the sovereign Lord employs his enemies for the preservation of his friends. Surely our God is able, if he chooses, not only to prepare a table for us in the presence of our enemies, and you know wrote that, he's able to make those very enemies load the table for us. The Apostle Peter assures us in his second letter, the Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of trial. He most certainly does. And in so doing, he sometimes works in the most surprising of ways. Because my God has an unlimited number of wonderfully unguessable means by which he is able to deliver his people. And there are two things which in particular strike Malcolm about David's deliverance here. First, I marvel at the way in which God used, as his instruments, men who were oblivious to the fact he was using them. Whatever motivated the Philistines to attack Israel, it certainly was not with a view to saving David's skin. After all, he'd once demolished their champion for them. I doubt that the Philistine lords ever found out the result of what they'd done. And our God works his will through men who are unaware of what he's doing. The Lord, through the prophet Isaiah, expresses my point very clearly when he describes the nation of Assyria as a rod in his hand. Makes it clear, he's completely in control of the Assyrians' actions. He was sending them, in his agenda, to discipline godless Judah, against whom at the time his anger burned. Then he quotes his exact words. I'm in Isaiah chapter 10, it's verses 5 and 6. The rod of mine anger, the staff in their hand is mine indignation, he says. He would send the Assyrian monarch against a hypocritical nation, against the people of my wrath will I give him a charge to take the spoil and to take the prey. That, incidentally, is a play on the name of his lad, Mahershal Hashbaz, that's what his name meant. The following verse is dynamite. Howbeit, God added, he meaneth not so. Neither doth his heart think so. It's in his heart to destroy and cut off nations, not a few. That is, the Assyrian king was altogether ignorant of the fact that when pursuing his own military ambitions, he was serving the Lord. Wasn't consciously doing that. The Assyrian king's plans were simply to steamroller and destroy as many nations as he could to build and extend his own empire. But Assyria was simply an unwitting tool in the Lord's hand that he would use to accomplish his purpose. Just as a little further down the road, he would take up Nebuchadnezzar, my servant, as he styled him. Or further again, one Cyrus, my shepherd, my anointed. And the very same was true of the Philistines in the days of David. And the Bible has many cases of the same kind. I want to cite you one from the New Testament. I'm in Acts chapter 24 and 5. Luke tells us that when Festus, who had been newly appointed procurator, comes into his province, after 3 days he went from Caesarea. That's where Paul is held in custody. He's in chains in Caesarea. And the procurator went from Caesarea to Jerusalem. And the high priest and the chief of the Jews informed him against Paul. I'm quoting Luke. And they besought him and desired a favor that he would send for him to be brought to Jerusalem, lying in wait on the way to kill him. But Festus answered that Paul should be kept at Caesarea, and that he himself would depart shortly there. Now when Festus decided to return to Caesarea to hear the case against Paul, he had no way of knowing that Paul's life was in the balance. That Paul's life depended on him making that decision. And in many ways, the decision of Festus was remarkable. It was completely unexpected. I guess it took the Jews completely by surprise, because it flew right in the face of the favor which they had asked him. And that was noteworthy for 2 reasons. First, the very last action of his predecessor, Felix, towards Paul, was dictated, Luke says, by his desire to do the Jews a favor. Same word. And secondly, Festus himself, when he does go and see Paul, asked Paul if he would agree to appear before him in Jerusalem, quote, because he wanted to do the Jews a favor. And yet, on this one critical occasion, Festus, for reasons known only to Festus, not to me, presumably not to Luke, refused to do them a favor, and in so doing saved Paul from ambush and certain death. And how different the history of Christianity would have turned out if Festus had decided the other way. But he had no idea that at that moment the Jews were poised to kill Paul any more than the Philistines had any idea that news of their attack would reach Saul at the very moment that he and his men were poised to kill David. I'll give you a case from church history. John Calvin, when young, was forced to leave his native France, travel east, hoping to reach Strasbourg. His desire was a haven in which to study and write and support the new Protestant faith. But a straight line to Strasbourg was impossible because there was a war in the way. It was 1536, and Francis I and Emperor Charles V were having their third war. They obviously enjoyed having wars. Cannon, carts, and equipment blocked the roads. So Calvin took a detour to the south, passing through Lyon. He hoped to reach Lausanne on a certain day, but failed and needed to spend the night in Geneva. And there, short and fiery William Farrell got hold of the young scholar and threatened him with the judgment of God if he didn't stay to carry on the Reformation in Geneva, which Calvin did. And the whole Christian world would be very different if he hadn't. And in one sense, I suppose we can say that we owe Calvin's impact on the Reformation to Francis I and Charles V. Because after all, humanly speaking, it was their war that forced Calvin to pass through Geneva. And humanly speaking, it was a large-scale Philistine assault which saved the life of another young man, of whose seed in due course was to come the Messiah and Savior of the world. But I said there were two things which strike me about David's deliverance. And the second is this, I marvel at God's perfect split-second timing. Because the one who orders and controls that vast cosmos out there moved the Philistines to invade Saul's territory and caused the timing of that calamity to reach the king's ear just as Saul's men were about to close in on David. Because if that Philistine invasion had taken place 1 week later, David and his men would have been 6 feet under the ground before the Philistines crossed the border. And the Christian doesn't need to fear. God's clock keeps strict time. You ask Queen Esther, you ask Mordecai. Zeresh, Haman's wife, and all his friends said to him, let a gallows be made 50 cubits high. That's 80 feet, by the way. And that is some ornament to set up in your garden. Let a gallows be made 50 cubits high, and tomorrow, note that, tomorrow, speak to the king that Mordecai be hanged thereon. And the thing pleased Haman, and he caused the gallows to be made. On that night could not the king sleep. Literally, sleep fled away from the king. He commanded that they bring him the book of the record of the chronicle, and the story continued. And how much rested, not only for Mordecai and Esther personally, but for the entire Jewish nation, on the fact that that was the night that Ahasuerus suffered an attack of insomnia. It's often been said, and quite rightly, that man's extremity is God's opportunity, and I have no doubt whatever that in the light of this day's events, David would have gladly signed up to that. How God delights to intervene and save when all human hope is gone, and in ways that men would least expect. And he does it because he's God. Verse 28. Wherefore Saul returned from pursuing after David and went against the Philistine. Sensing that this particular offensive posed a serious threat, Saul, and he must have muttered under his breath, saw no choice but to break off his personal vendetta against David and to postpone his pursuit. Flavius Josephus, Jewish historian, put his finger right on it. This is what he says about this chapter. He returned back again to oppose those Philistines who were naturally their enemies, that is, Israel's enemies, judging it more necessary to avenge himself of them than to take a great deal of pains to catch an enemy of his own. Yes. I read an interesting prayer. The man by the name of Alexander Peden, he was one of the Scottish Covenanters, a very keen Christian. And I'm quoting now the textbook. Once Peden and some others were being pursued by horse and foot soldiers. Peden and his friends gained some distance from their pursuers and stopped for a needed breather and desperate prayer. Peden prayed, Lord, this is the hour and the power of thine enemies. They cannot be idle. But hast thou no other work for them to do than send them after us? Send them after them to whom thou wilt give strength to flee, for our strength is gone. Now actually the Lord stepped in. He answered with a cloud of mist between them and their persecutors, and they escaped. I was fascinated by the prayer. Hast thou no other work for them than to send them after us? And certainly, in response to David's great prayer, save me, God found other work for Saul to do, and that's why there came a messenger. So the chapter more or less ends as it began, with a Philistine attack. But the assault of verse 27 is very different to that of verse 1, and that in at least two respects. Number one, in its object and its scale. In verse 1, the object of the Philistine raid was simply to plunder some threshing floors around just one Israelite city. But verse 27 speaks to us
of a much larger, a far more serious offensive against, quote, the land in general. Now, Saul could and did choose to ignore the one. He dared not ignore the other. But it differed also in its effect and consequence for David. One result of David confronting the Philistine raiders in verse 1 was that by doing it, he drew Saul's attention to him and almost enabled Saul's forces to surround and kill him. But one result of Saul confronting the Philistine invaders in verse 27 was that his attention was thereby diverted from David and enabled David to escape from Saul's forces that were surrounding him to kill him. And if the Philistine incursion in verse 1 spelt danger for David, the Philistine incursion in verse 27, of course, spelt deliverance for him. Because the very people responsible for Saul almost trapping and killing David at the beginning of the chapter, in attacking Israel again, were responsible for David's rescue and preservation at the end.